Welcome to Out of Material with me, Alexander Desi. In this series, I will be exploring the working minds of material scientists, specialists, designers, and thinkers, contemplating consumerism, design, sustainability, and climate change by looking to the future of material innovation and emerging technology. Pala Nelich is a materials designer, educator, and researcher with a primary focus on circular design. Her current research has yielded two new materials, Aquafab Biofoam and Coco001, aiming to eliminate food waste through conversion into biomaterials. Pala is also the co-founder of Circular Home Lab, an online workshop series promoting at-home regeneration of food waste into products of value. Pala, thank you so much for joining me on Out of Material.
Hi, Alexander. Well, thank you so much for inviting me for this chat. I really look forward to it.
I'd like to start by talking to you about the two materials you've developed yourself. Coco001 is a brittle material made of industrial chocolate waste, and Aquafaba Biofoam, which for anyone who doesn't know is made from the liquid that chickpeas are cooked in, is a bioplastic you've used to make tableware. You've placed a real emphasis on the value of transience, arguing that the temporary nature of these materials has the potential to create more value in the product while emphasizing the material's circular nature. Something I've noticed in my forays into sustainable material trends is a dichotomy between designing for durability, achieving sustainability by reducing the volume of resources consumed, and designing for biodegradability, producing products which may not last as long but leave no trace at the end of their use. I'd like to hear your view on whether these ideas are compatible in any way and how items that aren't necessarily long-lasting can still have value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think there are two really interesting aspects there. So, of course, it all depends on the resource that we're using, and it depends on the context, I think. With my materials, I use a resource that in itself won't last forever, you know. So it's got this quality that it will degrade after a while. It biodegrades, but it's also compostable. Building up on this sort of resource that I had, I decided to then create a material around that, around the qualities that the original main ingredient has, and translate that into the material and into my products. So my products are still at the moment in development and rather speculative, but they still contain this narrative of objects that will only last for as long as we either need them or as long as they're relevant, not as a product, but maybe as a nourishment for I would say their next stage, you know, the nourishment as a fertilizer and so on. Because we see products as that's it, you know, that's what we have, that's the product. Some last a long time, some don't, and then we forget about them. It's all about creating the circle. And so with my materials that I currently shape into speculative products, I look into the qualities that the material itself has. And these qualities come from the origin, from the resource that I'm using, which is the food waste, which is contained in the material aquafaba foam, but also cocoa. And when I'm sourcing, the main resource for my materials, I look at, okay, what does this resource offer? And the food waste or food surplus that I use in itself is a transient ingredient. It will biodegrade naturally, but it's also compostable. So I think it's really relevant to look at what's offered naturally and then translate that into a material and into a product. And of course, the final product will also contain the quality of biodegradability, unless I add toxic ingredients, fossil fuel, plastics, and so on, which force the product to last longer. So that's how I create my materials and products. But I also think it's really interesting to look at other resources. We'd be looking at resources that are really scarce and what do we aim to create from them? If it's a specific product, should it maybe have a longer life span just because the resource is so scarce and it's maybe also hard to return it into, you know, a circular system to reuse it again? So then we just need to redesign the product lifespan in a way, or the main design of the product in itself.
But do you have any do you have any examples in mind of a material made of a scarce resource?
So precious metals, of course, and of course it all depends on what recycling systems are available, where people are using the product that we create from these resources. Just looking at specific metals, you know, you might want to translate this high value that the main resource should have as it is scarce. You might want to translate that into the value of the end product as well. What I mean by that is if we find a way to visualize what a product is made from and in what context it stands within, you know, our life cycle in a way, and how it's connected to the natural resources, our environment, I think then people will naturally create a different connection to these products and also naturally give it different values. The value that our economic system gives a product is dictated by the narrative that is created in a weird, unnatural way through marketing and so on, and through the knowledge that is either shared or not shared. And I think a really great example of how a value of a resource is misperceived is, of course, fossil fuel. We don't have that much of it, but somehow it is now used in materials and products that are perceived as being super cheap, and recreate the narrative around that. I think that will have an impact on the value, and either the value for a transient materials and products or also the value for a longer living product.
Oh, thank you. I really like that idea of products having their real context, you know, where they actually came from and the process through which they were made, rather than just whatever spin marketing has chosen to take on it, or whatever idea is being put forward by some marketing company that actually has nothing to do with where the material comes from or what it's made of or the process it went through to be produced. So something else I've been thinking about is the value of things that we make ourselves by hand. So I've been 3D printing for the last few years and booked into a pottery workshop as well. They'll hopefully go ahead after the pandemic. And the things that I have a personal involvement in producing always mean more to me than something that's just been mass produced, because they have a unique story. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the Circular Home Lab is using this intrinsic value creation system to encourage people to move towards circular consumption and reuse systems.
Sure. So what we do in Circular Home Lab is a bit like pottery as well. We invite people from all over the world to join us in virtual workshops, which we've created during the pandemic, especially for this challenging situation that we all experience worldwide. And we felt, and we still feel, that it's really important to connect globally and see us as a global community. So we're tapping into that. And as I said, we invite people from all over the world to join us, and they will bring into the workshop dried powders from their own food waste or surplus. I use the term surplus because it just gives it more value, because in the end, if we have a system where we see so-called waste as a resource, it won't be waste anymore. So that's also a value that we incorporate in our workshops. We ask people to share with us what they collected, what food they eat, what is local for them, and how what they eat, which contains so much value, so much cultural value, and so many stories. We are really connected to the food that we eat, right? So they bring that in and they share that with each other and us. And those dried powders that they create in very simple steps, they also have very specific colors and scents. And that is immediately a really interesting experience, because they get involved with really reflecting, you know, what do I consume? Where did I buy this? Did I buy it locally? Or, you know, where did I get it? How is it transformed? And how is this so-called waste, in the end, this beautiful, scented, beautifully colored powder that I can then use to create my own materials? So what we do is we basically say, okay, let's tap into the most local resource we have, which is our household waste, and create materials and objects in a process that is very pottery-like. So I think you'd enjoy it, actually. So we use open source recipes that are, for example, based on agar-agar. So we're using, you know, this algae-based powder. We mix it with other ingredients that we find in our kitchens, and then mix in our powders, and we craft our own objects. I would call it a holistic experience, almost, in really connecting with the material and with the object. And you said it so rightly, I think we connect with what we make ourselves more than what is made by others. And I think it just comes naturally. For us, it's easiest to connect to our immediate environment. It's always hard, you know, to understand what's happening on the other side of the world. I think the pandemic is the first time in human history that we feel a global connection, because we are all experiencing the same. I think, yeah, what we hope to do with Circular Home Lab is create a space for exploration, for sharing, and for reconnecting with the resources that are around us. You know, it doesn't even need to be waste. We could also say, hey, can you go into a nearby forest and see what plants are out there? And can you, you know, mindful way, maybe source, for example, berries and use them to color your materials and then make an object from that. So we've had really great feedback from people, yeah, with the processes they've experienced, and also, yeah, sharing with the other participants that might be from South America, you know, Europe, India, other Asian countries, the USA. So it's really interesting.
It's fantastic. I think you're actually going almost a step further with what you're doing, because you're creating something so personal. You know, if you go to a pottery class and you're making something, you're injecting your personality into it, you're creating something you want to create, but you're still ultimately using clay that's been brought in by whoever's running the workshop, for example. Or if you're making stuff at home with a 3D printer, you're still using filament that you've had to buy, whereas this is really from scratch, making a material out of, as you say, the surplus material from food that you personally have eaten. And eating is such a personal event in itself, communion of eating with your family, or, you know, eating with someone you love, or eating food that you love, and then taking that one step further and actually creating something of value that can stay with you for a time beyond just that moment of pleasure when you eat the food.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what we hope to do. We hope to, in a way, also create a, you know, a space where we can empower people to see how, you know, each one of us can actually play a part in recreating this current system that we have, and yeah, and introduce new ways of approaching surplus communicating in a different way. We have people from all sorts of professions joining us, and also many designers. And it's really interesting to see, you know, they will take those new skills into their own practice. It's really fun.
You talk a lot about this, the importance of interdisciplinary collaboration and this idea of working as unified inhabitants of the earth to support its well-being. Buckminster Fuller says in his operating manual for Spaceship Earth that only complete world desovereignization can permit the realization of an all humanity high standard support. Something I've been thinking about off the back of this is how programmers will often upload their code to the internet open source and encourage other developers to take their own spin. Academics and researchers in universities collaborate endlessly, and the maker community clearly values the sharing of knowledge. Your own workshops use open source recipes, but industry seems a bit constrained by things like trade secrecy and intellectual property. While, of course, free market capitalism encourages innovation through competition, it's clear that your vision of the future involves a much more open network of knowledge and resources. For example, the industrialized production of your cocoa material would require a collaboration between chocolate factory waste streams and a material production plant. Do you think these barriers will just start to break down naturally as markets for these kinds of things grow? Or do corporations need to be more forward thinking if they're going to reduce their ecological impacts?
Yeah, well, really great question. And I have to say, I still struggle with these different aspects, for sure. Maybe I will quickly share that, you know, when I started about a year ago with my material design, I started as an independent material designer. And I was quickly, for some way, pushed into the startup world, which is very profit-driven. And I ended up an accelerator program. And just because I was curious how one could actually bring these materials to the market. And I was so amazed how protective everyone is, how profit is so important, and even having basic conversation about, let's say, how do you deal with your everyday life as a material designer can be quite a challenge. And I quickly understood, of course, why is that? Because in our current economic system, we are somehow pushed into a forced, to think of profit and to protect our work, because you need to bring food to your table. So how do you do that? You need to make money, you know, in our current system. And this is protected by protecting your IP and so on. So it was a really interesting experience. And yeah, I also think there is much value in how many designers approach this, and especially startups. I have much respect for startups taking on, you know, the world. And there are really amazing new material startups. Let's name AlgaeKnit, for example. I think they're amazing in what they do. But of course, they will also have their IPs protected and so on, which is very important. And it will help them to get investment and to get the material to the market, which can then change a lot, have big positive impact, hopefully. Yeah, I have to say, I still see that there's a big division, you know, but, and I think you touched on that, of course, as well, sort of looking at this corporate world, but also the startup world, then also individual designers who need to make a living, and then the world of open source, academia, and so on. And I recently started to study again, and I love how everyone just collaborates and exchanges ideas. And, you know, we have these wonderful sandpit events, and we have so many different experts in our hub, at the Hub for Biotechnology in the Built Environment at Newcastle University. And there I really see that, you know, people are wanting to co-create, collaborate, and nurture each other's ideas, which will then again, you know, drive innovation and drive change, positive change. And I think ideally, we would find a way out of this system where people think, I need to protect my work to make profit. And they only do that because they are forced to do that by the system, you know. If there was a way of saying, okay, where is the value? Maybe the value can be in sharing the knowledge and the skills. Maybe the value is not in pushing the growth of our company, but rather saying, okay, if we nurture each other's process, then this will overall create growth, but maybe a more sustainable and lasting growth. Because, you know, we're not independent in our world. We need each other. So, sorry, that goes into an area where maybe thinking more, approaching this more emotionally maybe, which is very far away from, you know, the economic system. But yeah, I'm just trying to find a way, you know, of connecting these two worlds. And in a way with Circular Home Lab, we're trying to do that. You know, we still make our living from offering, from sharing, but we also hope to feed new visions and ideas and new processes. So I'm afraid I don't really have an answer. I just have a lot of hope.
That's a great answer. You know? I was going to say that lots of people that I speak to sort of express an understanding for the need for remedial climate action, but often seem hesitant to actually change anything in their own lives. And this could be down to any number of factors, money, time, foresight. But a big trend is this feeling of insignificance compared to the damage that's done by corporations. And I think personally that everything is so intertwined that in reality, the consumer is essentially the corporation, since we drive demand and our behaviors and buying patterns directly influence the market. Now, what I love about what you're doing is that you're putting that process directly into the hands of people. You're saying, well, here's how you can make a change. Here's how you can create something of value from scratch for yourself. No need for any other third parties. Just do it all at home. You know, I'd love to hear a bit more about how you think we can encourage more people to engage in less convenient but more sustainable practices rather than just relying on the fast, damaging product.
I think a lot of change has already happened, really driven by the younger generations that are asking the right questions and maybe expressing that they feel like, what can I do? I don't know. But they're still pushing corporations to change how they act. And I think especially in the past 2 years, we've seen many, many changes. And suddenly, huge corporations managing to redesign their products and their manufacturing systems. But they only did that because they were pushed by the consumers. And also, of course, by government regulations. But these government regulations only happened because people spoke up. Again, it's all connected. And I think also in the past political situations and so on, we see that as soon as one person starts to ask, why is this happening, other people will join. And with Circular Home Lab, of course, we only reach, you know, a very small percentage of people, but hearing what they think and maybe, you know, sharing some of our values already hopefully creates some change and hopefully will grow as well. I think that another really great thing is that I feel people are craving new experiences, and not only because in this pandemic we have way less experiences, you know, but also just the way that the world is changing. I think we want to feel more connected to what we consume. We want to see our values reflected in certain products, but also we value experiences in a different way. So these experiences, or the value of these experiences, could actually be used by larger corporations to say, okay, maybe people will be more open to crazy new products that are part of a more sustainable system, but might be very different. And maybe when we use them, feel less comfortable because, gosh, we might need to reconsider, you know, what we do with a product after use and so on. But in the end, if the story around the product is interesting and we feel connected to it, we will be more open. And I think even the laziest among us will be excited, you know. Yeah, if we can do an Insta story about how we're using this product, we're already happy. We feel like, okay, what we spent on the product has already been, you know, returned to us in a way. So I think there are many, many new opportunities in rethinking. And I hope that more corporations get on board with that. And the people will thank them for that.
I think that's a really great point. Something I was talking to Andrew about was how people have these really hardwired preconceptions about what materials are, what they feel like, what they smell like, what they should be used for, and how subverting those preconceptions can often make people stop and think and say, oh, this is being used in a way that I'm not used to. I'm interested in this. I want to know more. And something I really admire about your work is your commitment to improving that individual user experience. You explored taste and smell in your graduate collection. And do you think that the stimulation of a wider range of senses creates a more intimate interaction with a product? But we've been talking about focusing on experience over function in design, and maybe it's a synergy of both. Maybe that's what's needed to give people a more meaningful connection to the materials that they interact with.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, as soon as certain, you know, senses are triggered, something will happen. In a way, it will activate certain emotions, it will bring up specific memories. Maybe if we're looking at scent can carry whole stories. I saw this beautiful piece at an exhibition. It was like an evaporator, I'm not sure. So it was giving out the scent of smell of rain on warm soil on a summer evening. And I love that. And even before reading the sign next to it, I smelled it and I had these ideas of a forest and of warm rain for some reason. And then I read the sign and I was like, wow, okay. And I think these are very special ways of communicating something that we can incorporate more into products and materials. It will always be a very individual experience, for sure, as you said. We all have different experiences and our senses react to what we know because they will connect it to our brain, and our brain can only tap into information that it has. So maybe someone else might not have immediately felt, oh, it's something about warm rain. Maybe they would not have understood, depending on where they live and which environment and so on. And in my graduate collection, I used scents of specific trees. So again, of course, if you've never encountered this tree, you might not recognize the scent. So in a way, I think these immersive experiences that can be created by designing four different senses in our products can be a really new way of connecting to the products and materials. With my cocoa material, really everyone who's encountered it immediately said, okay, I recognize this scent. And even the way it looks, the texture, so the material, or I try to reflect the origin of the material in the visuals, you know, of the material as well, so that people can immediately, in a way, understand. I also think that even though it's very individual, in a way, I see it as a strong communicator. It's almost like, you know, almost like a non-verbal language that we can use to tell a story or to communicate an idea. it's again something that can connect us even beyond, you know, beyond speech. And I think this could be the same for touch and other senses, definitely, where I see much potential to incorporate that in future product development.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that we're, you know, we're sat here talking about designing for the senses as a new thing, but I think it's just something that's often really overlooked. I think it's something that's always been there. I think any product anyone interacts with, they're unconsciously having some form, some kind of reaction to the smell, the way it feels. All these sensory experiences mean so much to people. I forget where I heard about it, but there was an art gallery that was closed down for a big refurbishment, and the main thing that all the regulars who went to the gallery all the time were saying, please keep the smell the same, because that was what they associated with going to that gallery and experiencing that art. It was the smell of the gallery, and that affected the way that they perceived the art and the way that they consumed these beautiful pieces, was just the way the gallery smelled. And that's something that would never spring to mind until that gallery got closed down. So I think the idea of scent as being something truly important in the way that people experience a product or an experience even is really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, although I think it was Lee Edelcourt, you know, this global trend forecaster, she introduced the idea of bringing back sensory design, I think, a decade ago, and still something has evolved from that, but not enough, not for the mass audience. And yeah, especially when looking at art and design environments, we see that maybe there is almost like a playground to try out these new experiences and products with an audience that is very aware of that, of the probably very dusty smell of an art gallery. So they probably had to bring back dust into the gallery after refurbishment for the smell. Or I'm very curious to find out more about the story of this gallery. It sounds really fun.
Yeah, I think we've touched on some really interesting things about designing for individuals versus designing for the masses, you know, and something I noticed was that you mentioned your personality types in a few places. You're an INFJ, MBTI personality type, and I just wanted to ask you about how an understanding of your own way of seeing the world in contrast with the other personality types, how that informs your design processes, and whether or not you think it's ever actually possible to appeal to the masses.
I share my personality type on LinkedIn, yeah, as a way of sharing a bit more about myself. I think I learned about these personality types in the startup accelerator that I was part of, where they said, okay, before you actually start working with your team, you know, actively, or before you found your startup, each one of you should do a personality test, and the others need to read it to understand who the other person is that they will be working with, you know, very closely. Because, and I was amazed. I thought this was so great, because it's what we are human, and what we seek is connecting to other people. I think it's something that comes naturally. We are very social beings. We depend on each other. And to understand the other person's, you know, values, way of thinking, what drives them, which is incorporated in these personality types, I think this will really help to work well in a team, to split up the tasks and so on, but also how we communicate with each other. I still do this sort of, in my collaborations, I encountered many people that actually said, yeah, let's share the personality type. And it's such a great start, because if you feel like, okay, you're getting to know the other person a bit better. And especially during this, you know, time where you can mostly meet people only virtually, it helps to create this understanding. I incorporated that into my practice a lot. It's not, you know, if you want to collaborate with me, you don't need to share a personality type with me. But I think it's, it's something that we could also consider when, like, you're talking about how to connect with the masses or reach out to them. I think these different, look, just looking at the different personality types, I've read through all of them just out of curiosity, you know, I saw that, okay, everyone has something that they care about and that will drive them. And tapping into that will help to understand what different consumer groups wants, what, or maybe to connect to different people, communities, and so on, to really understand, okay, what is that you care about? Because I think everyone cares about something. So even if maybe it's sometimes we think, gosh, you know, we have climate change and all sorts of massive challenges, and some people are still throwing their plastic wrapping just on the ground, on the street, and we feel, oh, maybe they don't care, but they do care about something, just maybe.
The way it's presented, maybe.
Yeah, and maybe we've not found a way yet to connect to that. You know, within their small community, they will have people that understand them. But if we're looking at how maybe, you know, larger corporates could create products that communicate specific values and then again connect to, you know, the broad masses in order to, I don't know, maybe incite more sustainable behavior, or to again nourish the feeling of a global community. I think it could be possible. It's not about finding ways to control people, not like that, but just finding out what are their values, and these values, they matter a lot. We can't assume that what we think is right for everyone else and for the world. So I think it's really about listening to each other and trying to find different points of connecting.
Thank you so much, Paola. This has been absolutely fascinating. Really, really have enjoyed this conversation. That's everything I wanted to ask you about.
Well, thank you so much, Alexander. Thank you for this really lovely chat. I feel inspired as well. So yeah, thank you so much.